Welcome to Simply Scottish, a podcast of all things Scottish, with music, features, interviews, and more, on the web at www.simplyscottish.com.
Welcome to Simply Scottish, the half-hour show of Scottish topics and music. I'm Andrew McDermott, your host. On this episode, part two of a series, we're highlighting more key moments in Scottish history by sharing shortlisted entries from our Moment in Scottish History contest. At simplyscottish.com, you'll find an episode guide to every show we've produced, including music playlists and links to other resources on the web. You can also read the Simply Scottish blog and email us. That's on our website, www.simplyscottish.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Get Scottish news, photos, trivia, and show updates at facebook.com/simplyscottish or twitter.com/simplyscottish. Let's start with music. This is Catriona MacDonald with a medley that includes the Monday Morning Reel and Eiley's Trip in Germany.
Thank you.
listening to Simply Scottish. In 2013, we held a contest called A Moment in Scottish History, in association with BBC Home Entertainment. To enter, participants needed to choose a single moment in Scotland's history and communicate it creatively, clearly, and accurately in 60 words or less. A number of entries were submitted, spanning over 1,500 years. A grand prize winner and a shortlist of 15 finalists were chosen to be featured on the show. Put together, these 16 entries capture some of the most important moments in Scotland's long and colourful history. On a previous episode, we looked at the first eight, ranging from Rome's attempts to conquer the Caledonians to the cusp of union with England. On this episode, we'll look at the second eight, from the Battle of Culloden to the opening of the Forth Road Bridge. Our first moment is brought to life by Val Poehler in Falkirk, Scotland. The sun was bright. Despite its warmth, a shiver shook my spine that day I walked across the moor they call Culloden. The morbid air possessed me, charged with sighs of lost souls who linger, dreams gone sour. I turned, retreating from this wilderness of futile war, and never will I go again to that hell on earth, Culloden. The Battle of Culloden, fought on April 16, 1746, was the last pitched battle fought on British soil. It pitted a Jacobite force comprised of Highlanders, some Lowlanders, and some French, against a government force of mostly English and some Scots and Irish. The Jacobites were led by Prince Charles Edward Stuart, or Bonnie Prince Charlie, a claimant to the throne from the House of Stuart. The word Jacobite comes from the Latin Jacob, or James, a popular name for the Stuart royal line. The uprising of 1745 was the last of a series of attempts to overthrow the House of Hanover and restore the Stuart kings to the thrones of Scotland, England, and Ireland. After advancing into England, the Jacobites returned to Scotland and met the government forces near Inverness in the Highlands. The government army, led by the Duke of Cumberland, was larger, more provisioned, more organised, and likely more rested than the Jacobites. The battle occurred on the marshy fields of Culloden. It was short and bloody. Without being able to establish a Highland charge or engage in guerrilla warfare, the Jacobites were quickly overwhelmed by government artillery. In the space of an hour, between 1,500 and 2,000 Jacobites were wounded or killed, as opposed to the government's 50 deaths and around 300 wounded. The aftermath of the battle was equally brutal, as Cumberland the Butcher ordered survivors to be hunted down and killed. Many innocent people in the region were killed or harmed, homes were burned, and livelihoods dashed. Some Jacobites escaped, others were executed in England. A number of them fled to the Americas or served in other campaigns in Europe. Prince Charles escaped and went into hiding, eventually ending up back in France, never to return to Scotland again. Soon after Culloden, laws were passed that banned Highlanders from wearing clan colours or bearing arms. The Gaelic language was marginalised by officialdom. Clans lost land and power. The clan system suffered irreparable harm. Truly, Scotland changed forever during this period. For more information on the battle and visiting the site of the battle today, go to the website for the National Trust for Scotland at www.nts.org.uk/Culloden. 76 years after the Battle of Culloden, a reigning monarch would pay a state visit to Scotland for the first time since 1650. Anthony Stairs of Hodges Cove in Canada wrote our next moment. As His Majesty donned his bright red formal Highland attire at Holyrood, he could not help but be pleased. "Scott has done well," he thought. "I am a king of Scotland, and by God I look like a Scottish king. I will embrace all that was old Scotland, and our people, by our example, will embrace me as their own." In 1815, George IV, Prince Regent at the time, invited Walter Scott to dine with him. He wanted to meet the author of Waverley, Scott's widely popular historical novel about the Jacobite uprising of 1745. In 1821, George IV was crowned king. In an effort to ease unrest and tension in Scotland over calls for reform, plans were brought forward for a state visit to Scotland. Scott took the opportunity to prepare a grand pageant for the occasion, an effort designed to give ancient Scotland rebirth and rebrand the parodied king as a stately gentleman and new Jacobite king that the people of Scotland would be proud to support. The king placed an order for over £1,300 worth of Highland outfit in the bright red royal tartan that would later be known as the Royal Stuart plaid. Scott ordered that all men attending the grand ball would be wearing the Highland dress as well. At this point, the kilt truly became the national dress of Scotland, as a large number of Lowlander nobles scrambled to outfit themselves in what was so recently considered an outlawed and primitive garb. The king arrived in Leith and led a procession through Edinburgh, where he was presented with the keys to the city. He was treated to Scottish country dancing, presentations of clans, traditional music, and even a production of Scott's Rob Roy at the theatre. The whole affair was beneficial as a whole for Scotland. An increase in goodwill resulted, as well as renewed interest in clan heritage, the kilt, and tartans that continues today. With all the pomp and circumstance of George IV's visit, there was probably little opportunity to address the Highland clearances, which had been going on in the Scottish Highlands for decades. Philip MacEachin of Tor, Scotland, brings this moment into focus. The total collapse, destruction, and eviction of a mild, loyal, and supportive people, thrown, crushed, faceless, burnt, and lost, unloved, uncared for, dismissed, kicked, and bruised, dispatched without repair, coastal bound, a remodelling exercise, headcount reduction, now left with only yawning gaps from strath to strath, all quiet, and just below the cries of eagles, bleating sheep. The outcome and aftermath of the Battle of Culloden would forever alter the Highland and clan way of life. The ancient clan system of family and community steadily disintegrated. As well as an official desire to tame the Highlands and its people, economic conditions, poor harvests, and changing technologies in agriculture all played their part. Clan chiefs became detached from their clansmen. Between 1775 and 1850, chiefs and landlords began forcibly evicting large numbers of Highland families from their townships and homes during a period known as the Highland Clearances. They were making way for Cheviot sheep, whose hardiness to Highland conditions and large quantities of quality wool made them excellent moneymakers. Tenants were relocated to coastal settlements, forced to adopt a new way of life, or migrate to the lowlands or abroad in search of a better life. Within 50 years, the Highlands became one of the most sparsely populated areas in Europe. A number of resources are available to learn more about the Highland Clearances. One website, www.highlandclearances.co.uk, is produced in association with the Highland Council and contains lots of useful info and links. That's www.highlandclearances.co.uk. Here's music now from Chris Lee, an American singer-songwriter from North Carolina. From his album Bury the Kings, this is Culloden. Tin souls repeat history.
wants to see our television screens. Cheering the scenes a color day.
You're listening to Simply Scottish. Cormac Murray in Linlithgow, Scotland, submitted the next entry we're highlighting from our Moment in Scottish History contest. The lost child huddled amongst the coastal hillocks, seeking shelter. Rain was lashing down from an iron-coloured sky, waves rushing up from a churning sea. He saw the knoll of Skerebra, pieces of it torn away by the water. Almost blinded by rain, he could still swear that he saw the shapes of stone buildings amidst the ruined knoll. This moment recalls the discovery of the Neolithic settlement of Skara Brae, thanks to a storm that hit Orkney in 1850. The aftermath of the storm revealed the outlines of the buildings in the settlement, sparking a series of excavations in the 19th and 20th centuries. First thought to be a Pictish settlement from the Iron Age, radiocarbon dating in the 1970s confirmed that the village was actually much older, dating from between 3200 BC and 2200 BC. Today, Skara Brae survives as 8 dwellings, linked together by low covered passages. Each square room contains a central fireplace, a bed on either side, and a shelved dresser on the wall. Inhabited for around 600 years, the settlement was hidden from view for over 40 centuries. Today, the site is managed by Historic Scotland. Visitors can enjoy a fascinating glimpse into life around 5,000 years ago. A visitor centre features touchscreen presentations, resources for children, and displays of artifacts uncovered during the excavations. Find out more about this World Heritage Site at www.historic-scotland.gov.uk. Our next featured moment brings some much-needed humour to our survey of Scottish history. It's written by Katie Murray in Falkirk, Scotland. The shackle pressed around his foot, discordant screeching tore at his ears. The creature was furry and feathery all at once, with hardly enough blubber to combat the cold. The most awful sounds emanated from a proboscis to rival that of an elephant seal. Maybe if I ignore it, it will go away, the penguin thought, feigning indifference. William Spears Bruce led the Scottish Antarctic expedition between 1901 and 1904. Although his popularity is not as far-reaching as his contemporaries, such as Robert Falcon Scott or Sir Ernest Henry Shackleton, his achievements show Scotland's part in an age of exploration and included the first manned meteorological station in the Antarctic Territory, the discovery of new land east of the Weddell Sea, and a large collection of specimens. Bruce emphasised the Scottish nature of the expedition by including an official bagpiper. While trapped in the ice of the Weddell Sea in March 1904, the expedition carried out the following scientific experiment. They chained an emperor penguin to the piper's leg in order to observe how it would react to the music. The ship's doctor, Dr. Perry, said of the incident, "He played on his pipes, but neither rousing marches, lively reels, or melancholy laments seemed to have any effect on these lethargic, phlegmatic birds. There was no excitement, no sign of appreciation or disapproval, only sleepy indifference." It would seem not every living creature is visibly moved by the emotive, stirring sounds of the bagpipes. Our next moment comes from Morag Campbell in Dundee. "The marble pillars were untouched. Chandeliers still shed splinters of light across the blackened hallway. But the scorched remains of the fine oak staircase bore witness to the explosion. The evidence was clear. A paraffin-soaked handbag, a lady's umbrella, the sighting of two suspicious-looking women. A message. Farrington Hall. A protest against British tyranny. Blame Asquith and Company. Suffragettes." At the turn of the century, unrest was growing among circles of women from all backgrounds. Denied full voting rights or the right to pursue the same education opportunities as their male counterparts, groups began to form, some peaceable, others militant. In 1903, disappointed by the slow progress of non-violent protest, Emmeline Pankhurst and her daughters founded the Women's Social and Political Union in Manchester with the slogan, "Deeds, not words." They became known as the Suffragettes. Scotland soon became an important stage for the movement, with suffragettes like Flora Drummond leading the cause. Property was vandalised, meetings were disrupted, and women went on hunger strikes. Ethel Moorhead, the daughter of an army surgeon, became the first Scottish woman to be force-fed in prison. She threw an egg at Winston Churchill, an opponent of women's voting rights, and was jailed for breaking a glass case at the Wallace Monument. During the First World War, most suffragettes suspended their campaigns, and women played a valuable role in the war effort, occupying jobs that were once the domain of men. Legislation in 1918 and 1928 finally brought what the suffragettes had been fighting for: full voting rights for all women aged 21 and over. Campbell's submission refers to the destruction of Farrington Hall, one of Dundee's great mansions owned by the city's wealthy jute barons. A magnificent Gothic structure finely appointed with marble and crystal chandeliers, it was badly burned in 1913 by suffragettes who were angry at recent legislation designed to quell their cause. Back to music now, with Moira Kerr singing the classic song Loch Lomond.
Moon coming out in the gold.
This is Simply Scottish. On this episode, we're featuring more finalists from our Moment in Scottish History contest. Our next finalist entry is a moment from World War II, submitted by Norman Clark of Kirkcaldy, Scotland. Across the open front door, a banner. Welcome home. Over the threshold steps a thin young man who had left in 1939, then 19, and now returns for the first time in 1945. With the BEF to France, captured with thousands of other Scots, 5 long years as a POW in Poland. Not special, never discussed. This moment actually belongs to Clark's father, one of many Scots whose lives would be forever changed when they fought in the Second World War. Clark's father was part of the British Expeditionary Force, a preemptive defence started in 1938 and deployed to France in 1939 and 1940. Pushed back by the German forces, the BEF evacuated at Dunkirk. A number of soldiers were captured and became prisoners of war. All told, Scotland lost over 50,000 souls in the Second World War. Our last moment is a moment of national pride in Scotland. It was submitted by Robert McEwen in Dunfermline. I had watched and photographed the building of the Forth Road Bridge from the positioning of balloons to show its line until its opening on a misty morning in September 1964. As Her Majesty the Queen drove over the newly opened bridge, the shroud of mist lifted, revealing the new bridge in all its glory. A magnificent sight. 2 years after the Second World War, an Act of Parliament established a board to oversee the planning and building of a new bridge across the Firth of Forth. Although the Forth Rail Bridge had been in place since 1890, it allowed only trains to cross the water between Edinburgh and Fife. Vehicle traffic still used a ferry, or had to be diverted to the Kincardine Bridge, 15 miles upstream. In 1958, construction began on the Forth Road Bridge. When it opened in 1964, it was the longest suspension bridge outside the United States, and the fourth longest in the world. Finally, a dedicated corridor had opened up between southeast and northeast Scotland. A 24/7 crossing for goods, tourists and commuters. Today, work is underway on a new bridge to span the Firth of Forth, set to open in 2016. To learn more about the bridges spanning the Forth, listen to Across the Forth, an episode of Simply Scottish, available on iTunes and at our website, www.simplyscottish.com. More moments illuminating Scotland's history are featured in part one of this series. Thanks again to everyone who entered our Moment in Scottish History contest. And congratulations once again to Thor Ewing, our grand prize winner. You can hear Ewing's winning entry in part one of this series. That's it for this episode of Simply Scottish. Share your comments on this show and listen to other episodes at simplyscottish.com. And if you enjoy the music on this episode, enter our monthly music giveaway for a chance to win a free Scottish album of your choice from over 4,000 to pick from. That's sponsored by MusicScotland.com. You can enter online at www.simplyscottish.com. We'll close with music from Breabach. From the album The Big Spree, this is The Rolling Hills. I'm Andrew McDermott. Let's connect again soon to celebrate more of all things Scottish.
I've travelled far and I've wandered wide. I've seen the heart.
Simply Scottish is hosted and produced by Andrew McDermott. Show content, copyright 2013, Simply Scottish Media. All music is used with consent of copyright holders. Continue your Simply Scottish experience at simplyscottish.com. Thanks for listening.
Bury me low, where I can hear the bonny tweed flowing, a sweeter place I'll never know than the rolling hills o' the borders. Well, the I hear with my lass I strolled by the Tay. But all its beauties they fade away. Am I in the hills or the borders? When I die, bury me low, where I can hear the bonny tweed flow. A sweeter place I'll never know than the rolling hills or the borders. So mind, bonnie lassies there you'll find, and men say stunning yet say kind. Among the hills or the borders,
when I die, bury me low, where I can hear the bonnie tweed flow. A sweeter place I'll never know than the rolling hills or the borders. When I die, bury me low, where I can hear the bonny tweed flow. A sweeter place I'll never know than the rolling hills or the borders.